Hello, good morning, and welcome. I am delighted to be here. I'm so grateful for the privilege of being able to teach the Compass community, the only community at Village 7 Presbyterian Church that has its own t-shirt. We're going to go on a bus tour of 250 years of church history, but we're going to do it in just 6 months. How exciting. When I first came to Village 7, I went through the new members class, and it was taught by Joseph Wheat. And he said that Village 7 is five things. He said, we are Protestant, we are Reformed, we're Calvinist, we're Presbyterian, and we're Evangelical. And I thought, oh, this is great. I can't wait to hear him explain what each of these things mean. But he didn't. He launched into a sermon, and he never got back to how we were all five of these and what the history behind it was. So I put together this class. Now, you're probably saying, Bill, I don't know much about history. What does it mean to be Protestant? When did that start? I asked my mother when I was a little boy. She had grown up in the Roman Catholic Church until she left home. She left home, she left the church. I said, Mom, what does it mean, Protestant? And she says, that means that we protest the Roman Catholic Church. That's not what it means. We'll find out what it means. What does it mean to be Reformed? Who were those people? What does it mean to be Calvinist? Calvinism happened after Calvin? Ooh. What does it mean to be Presbyterian? Where did that come from? And when? And then what does it mean to be evangelical? Where did that begin, the modern understanding of the word evangelical? Now, you're probably thinking to yourself, self, gosh, do I have to write down notes for all of this? The answer is no. All of these slides are at billpetra.com/compass. Easy to remember. billpetra.com/compass. And what does the website look like? Glad you asked. So, looks like this for each one of the rows. For example, today, over on the right is a link to the PDF slides that are already there. You could go there now and click and look at all the notes. Don't read ahead. The recording that I'm making right now, if it works, I will post this afternoon there, December 7th, a day that shall live in infamy. And then, finally, I've added some related articles that I've written over the last 40 years that relate to this lesson. Each week we'll have a different set of articles. So you're probably wondering, well, Bill, I'm really excited about covering 250 years of church history, but I would really like to know more about the history of Christmas. And I'm glad you asked. If you go to billpetra.com/blog, you will see the 10 latest blog articles I've written on history. I started at the beginning of Advent, which was last Sunday, and I have an article every day between now and Epiphany, which is in January, on the history behind Christmas. About 40 years ago, somebody asked me, Bill, what's the history behind the Christmas tree or the Christmas star, or why did Augustus call for a census? Who was Herod the Great? Was he good? Was he bad? What about a Charlie Brown Christmas? The important questions. So go there. Church history is divided into four parts: ancient church history, medieval or Middle Ages, the modern period, and then the postmodern period. to break it down, the ancient period goes from the time of Christ to the decline of the Roman Empire, about 600 AD. From there, the medieval or Middle Ages, that's what medieval means, from then until about the time of the Renaissance. The modern period takes it from the Renaissance. There's the early modern, which is about 1500, a time of religious conservatism and the rise of the Reformation. The late modern, about 1700s, with the intellectual optimism of the Enlightenment. And then the postmodern period, starting in about 1900 in Europe, in America, post-World War II. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. The first part is theological definition during the ancient period, theological darkness during the medieval period, sometimes called the Dark Ages, and then theological reformation during the modern period. Another way of looking at this is the ancient period was a time of the formulation of our doctrine and theology. Men like Origen, St. Augustine really captured the genius of the New Testament gospel. And during that time, there was discussion about various heresies. Arianism, for example, which was addressed at the Council of Nicaea, and this morning we recited the entire Nicene Creed that said Jesus is God, very God of very God. Arius said there was a time when Christ was not. So there was a council held in Nicaea near Constantinople 700 years ago this year. What a celebration to wrestle with the question of the Trinity. Number of other creeds, the word credo means I believe. Number of other creeds came out during this time, the Apostles' Creed, the Athanasius Creed. And so it was wrestling with heresy. It was defining clearly things related to the nature of Christ. Is he 50% God, 50% man? No, that doesn't work. Was he a man who became the Christ? Was he God who looked like a man? All of that was wrestled with during the ancient period, which we're not going to talk about. The medieval period was the time of, we would call this a decline, because it was the rise of sacramentalization, the sacraments, the seven sacraments, taught by Peter Lombard and Thomas Aquinas. We're going to talk about that today. The modern period was a rediscovery of the biblical texts, and people like Martin Luther, who you may have heard of, John Calvin, Ulrich Zwingli, John Knox, we're going to spend almost all of our time in the modern period. And then the postmodern period with people like Kant and Schleiermacher and Freud and Darwin, which we're not going to talk about at all. Okay, great. So the Renaissance had two children. One was the Reformation, the second was the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was the end of both the Reformation and the end of the Renaissance. And the Renaissance started appearing in Europe late 1300s, 1400s, especially in Renaissance art. Not in England until about the 1500s. So you see Renaissance literature in England in the 1500s. William Shakespeare, for example. All right, Renaissance. What does Renaissance mean? Anyone? This is the interactive part of the class. Renaissance.
Renewal.
What's that? Exactly correct. Renaissance is a French word, renaissance, it's called the rebirth. So if you've ever seen it in papers where it says Mary Smith, née Brown, née means she was born with the name Brown. Renaissance is rebirth. The motto of the Renaissance was ad fontes in Latin. So in this class, you're going to learn a little bit of Latin and a little bit of Greek. Ad fontes means back to to the sources. Well, what sources? In 1453, the city of Constantinople, which was the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire and also the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church, fell to the Ottoman Turks. The Muslims came in, and the scholars fled from Constantinople and came to Europe, primarily to northern Italy, Tuscany area. By the time of Martin Luther, the Ottoman Turks are knocking on the gates of Vienna. And as you can see here, they've already taken Bucharest, right on the edge of Beograd, but they're going to Budapest and then to Vienna. So these scholars fled from Constantinople. We're talking about poets, writers, grammarians, lecturers, musicians, astronomers, architects, artists, scribes, philosophers, scientists, theologians. They fled before the Ottoman Turks came to Italy. Northern part of Italy, the oldest university in Europe is Bologna. It had been established 300 years previously, but now you get all these scholars infused into the university at Bologna and other places in the north, like Padua and Mantua, names that you're familiar with from reading Shakespeare. So in these academies, they brought their classic works that had been lost in Europe but preserved in Constantinople. Latin works during the time of the Roman Republic and Empire, and Greek works which went back even further. So in Italy, when we talk about the Renaissance, here's some examples. Michelangelo painted the Sistine Chapel early 1500s. Leonardo da Vinci painted the Last Supper in a monastery in Milan. Please book ahead because there are buses of Japanese tourists. You won't be able to get in to see it. Machiavelli in Italy wrote The Prince, a wonderfully political document that says, look, if you're going to topple the king, if you're going to do a coup, make sure you kill his entire family, including his children. Don't send them into exile because they'll come back and kill you. It was very Machiavellian. Dante wrote the Divine Comedy, and in one section, the Inferno, he talks about hell. He takes a tour led by Virgil through hell, and hell is like an upside-down wedding cake. It's like a funnel, and the lower down in hell that you go to, into the Inferno, that's where you find the popes. Whoa! He wrote satire, kind of like Saturday Night Live. Or Christopher Columbus. He was Italian. He was from Genoa, financed by the Spanish to go to the New World. You've probably heard about him. He was in all the newspapers. So what is the meaning of Renaissance? One, it is the revival of classical learning, Greek and Roman learning. It is a methodology. It is not a philosophy. Nor is it a forerunner of modern democratic liberalism. We will hear the word humanist several times in our lessons. Martin Luther was a humanist. Zwingli was a humanist. But they were not secular humanists. Okay? That doesn't come until the time of the Enlightenment. Stay tuned. Let me show you two contrasting worldviews. If you're a medievalist, you see light and darkness. Since the time of Christ, medievalists would say, we live in the age of light. But before Christ, in those pagan days, it was all darkness. That's if you're a medievalist. If you're a Renaissance person, you say, we have escaped the Dark Ages. Now, Dark Ages was made up by Plutarch in the 1300s. It wasn't a time of darkness, But what they said is, we didn't really have light during the medieval period. We go back to the light that happened before Christ, the ancient world of Greek and Roman literature. In fact, it even survived after Christ into the time of the Roman Empire. They have a different worldview of light and darkness. Contrast between Renaissance and Reformation. Renaissance, primarily in Southern Europe, a little bit in terms of architecture, if you go to France, not so much in England in terms of architecture. Reformation was in Northern Europe, Germany, the Netherlands, Switzerland, a little bit in France, and then we'll talk about England and Scotland. The language of the Renaissance was Latin. The language of the Reformation was Germanic. Renaissance goes back to pre-Christian roots. The Reformation goes back to the Christian roots, the biblical roots. Classical humanism in the Renaissance, biblical worldview in the Reformation. Renaissance was about arts and science and architecture and literature. The Reformation was about faith, rediscovering the genius of New Testament thinking. So, what was the Reformation? Well, it depends on who you ask. If you ask Roman Catholics, they would say it is a heresy inspired by Martin Luther from base motives such as a desire to marry. He was in his 40s when he got married. He was very reluctant to marry. We'll talk about that in the next couple weeks. If you're a rationalist like Voltaire, you'll say, well, it's the consequence of a monastic squabble in Saxony, Germany. Well, yes, but it was a lot more than that. If you're a Marxist, you would say it is the result of the Roman papacy's exploitation of Germany. So you have to use the word exploitation, that's the part of Marxism, and class. If you've got class and exploitation, you've got the Marxist answer for everything. If you ask the Protestants, what is the Reformation? They would say it's a movement which sought to recover the purity of primitive Christianity revealed in the New Testament. The Reformation asked four questions. How is a person saved? That's a very important question. Number two, where does religious authority come from? Is it from the Church of Rome? Is it from the Pope? Is it from tradition? What is the Church? And what is the essence of Christian living? These four questions we'll see as we move through the following lessons. Now, before we get to the good news of the Reformation, we have to look at the bad news of what was going on in the 1300s. The Reformation came about because of three things: the milieu, the message, and the means. The milieu was that there was trouble inside the Roman Church and outside the Roman Church, political issues. The message was authority is only the Bible, and we are saved by grace through faith. The means was the movable type Gutenberg printing press. Without the printing press, the Reformation as we know it today would not have happened. It was the internet of its day. So, the church. Problems inside the church. There was mysticism inside the church. There was the Babylonian captivity. We'll talk about that in a couple of slides. But from outside the church, socioeconomic change with the crumbling of feudalism, lord and serfs and peasants, the Ottoman Turks knocking on the gates of Vienna, the rise of nationalism amongst the Holy Roman Empire, which covered all of Germany, parts of Italy, little bits of France. And humanism. How does the church deal with classical humanism? One other problem was the Black Death. Now, when I taught this class 10 years ago, people go, I can't relate. In a post-COVID world, we have a little bit of sympathy. Within 3 to 4 years, one-third to one-half of Europe was decimated by this plague, probably the bubonic plague. It came from the Russian steppes and areas in China, but it really launched from Crimea and the Black Sea. It sailed through Constantinople in 1347, swung around into Europe, landed at Genoa in Italy. From there, it spread all over Europe, as far as London and even Copenhagen. Modern-day Poland was pretty much spared. But think about the implications of losing a third to a half of the population. So look at the people on either side of you. What if they're gone? Think about workers. Now you have one-third or one-half less serfs to do the work on your manorial estate. Well, now they can demand wages. What if the owners of those estates are gone? Well, property becomes plentiful because people are few. But think about the spiritual implications of a plague of this nature. You go to your priest and you say, my daughter is dying of the plague. Please pray for her. And your daughter dies. Well, I thought if I go to the priest and have him pray that she'll survive, what's wrong with my priest? People started doubting the effectiveness, the spirituality of their priests and bishops. By the way, about half the priests died because they were attending to the sick, but they couldn't stop this plague. Are we being judged by God? It was devastating to European society. There are whole classes at university taught about what the plague did to Europe's economy and religiously. In the early 1300s, there was a pope named Boniface VIII. He was the most powerful of all the Roman popes, and he wrote a bull. A bull is a document that is sealed with a wax seal that is called a bulla in Italian, no, in Latin. And a bull is a document called the Unum Sanctum. Unum Sanctum means one holy. And he said, the true faith compels us to believe that there is one holy universal apostolic church. He lifted this right out of the Nicene Creed at the end. We said that this morning. Okay, I'm with you. Outside of her, there is no salvation or remission of sins. What exactly do you mean by that? Both swords, the spiritual and the temporal, are in the church's power. What? The spiritual sword, okay, I understand that. You're claiming political, governmental power. Outrageous. Some of the kings had some heartburn with this. He would excommunicate kings for a variety of reasons and place an interdict on their realm. An interdict means the priest will not marry, bury, or baptize. That's a bad thing for your realm. So they were under his thumb. He died. They beat him up and died of a fever. When he died, the next pope was French. Now, the papacy owned some property in France, and the new pope in France said, I like France. I don't want to go to Rome. I don't want to live there. And so he set up shop in Avignon, which is down in the Provence area of France. Really nice wine. Anyway, so they moved there for 70 years. And all the popes were French. They had a vacation house. They had a castle away from there where they would spend their July and their August called Chateau Neuf du Pape, which means the new castle of the Pope. And if you go out there, the remains of it are destroyed. The Nazis destroyed it during World War II as the Allies were marching north from Marseille. And I got to see the castle. And I thought, my father was marching north from Marseille with the American army. Anyway, that area, if you go into any of the wine places, you get a bottle of Chateau Neuf de Pape, and on it are the keys of the kingdom and the Pope's hat. Go to a liquor store and buy some wine that is Chateau Neuf de Pape, and it has that. That's where they would spend their summers. Anyway, they became like French government officials. They lived in opulence. The priests, although they had given, they had taken vows of celibacy and poverty, became rich. And you, if you were celibate, you could not marry, but you could have as many concubines as you could financially support. Well, this eroded confidence in the church. They're there for 70 years. That's why it's called the Babylonian captivity. And the Pope returns to Rome. They elect a Pope in Rome. Though the Pope refuses to support the French cardinals, French cardinals declare a new Pope in Avignon. So now you've got two popes. Now, here's the problem with Avignon popes. They're in France. If you send your money to the church, it goes to France. France is at war with England. England doesn't want to send their money to France. But you've got a pope in Rome and you've got a pope in France. Who is the one who has the keys to the kingdom? The Roman Catholic Church says the pope holds the keys to the kingdom. That's the symbol. Anywhere in Rome, if you find a church that has the pope's cap and the crossed keys of the kingdom, that is a Vatican church, even though it's in Rome. So amongst the 400 churches in Rome, if you see that, it's a Vatican church. Who holds the keys? Well, you got two popes. They, of course, excommunicate each other. It's called the Western Schism. All right, so the Council of Pisa, let's get rid of both of them and come up with a new pope. Yay! Well, the other two decide we're not going to step down. It's a mess. Theologically, Peter Lombard says, here's how salvation begins. First, it's based on the atonement of Christ. Then it's administered by the Spirit through the sacraments. If you attend to the seven sacraments, it affects virtues in the individual by faith, and you merit increased merit that hopefully will result in justification, progressive justification. That's not what we believe. Ask a Roman Catholic, how do you know you go to heaven? I asked my mom that. I was 5. How do you know you can go to heaven? She said, well, if you're good more often than you're bad. I was a math major back then. I knew I was not hitting 51%. This was bad news. 7 sacraments: baptism, confirmation, Eucharist, penance, unction, orders, and matrimony. Eucharist and penance you do every week. Eucharist is the Lord's Supper. Penance is saying confession, usually to a priest. 2 of them are mutually exclusive: taking orders, meaning becoming a priest or a nun, taking a vow of celibacy, or matrimony. You can't do both of them. There are 3 states, Peter Lombard said. We're in a state of innocence, we move toward perfection, or we can fall into sinfulness. The way this works is baptism, when you baptize an infant, that's the new birth, they're innocent. The Eucharist, confirmation, or taking orders moves us toward perfection. We can prevent ourselves from falling into sin by getting married. And I'm sure that's why all of you got married. If you should fall into sinfulness, penance, confession, and unction, that is anointing, could move you back up. That's the Roman Catholic view during the medieval period of the 7 sacraments. So here's how it works out. the merit of Christ, who lived a perfect life, is held in a treasury of merit in the sky. And also the merit of saints, because they did more good works than they needed to, their merit goes into this treasury of merit that it does not become available to you or I except through the church. The church administrates that merit to us as we observe the sacraments. Are you having heartburn yet? Thomas Aquinas, the great doctor of the church, said in the beginning, there's a gratuitous infusion of grace from Christ. Then we cooperate with God morally, doing the best that we can with the aid of God's grace. And the reward of eternal life is a just due to us if we do good works. We may have to go to purgatory to purge our sins after we die, but eventually we'll go to heaven. With me so far? So Thomas Aquinas said, the remission of sin is a result of the infusion of righteousness initially and our own righteous works that merit the merits from the treasury of merit. The reformers had a different idea. They said it's not the infusion of righteousness. We have no righteousness in ourselves, even if we do good works. Instead, it is the instantaneous imputation of Christ's righteousness to us. By faith, because of God's grace, Christ's righteousness is imputed to us, and our sin is imputed to Christ, who took those sins on the cross. That is a revolutionary idea, and that is why the Reformation was so outrageously different. We'll close with a problem child. This is Prince Albert of Brandenburg. He's under 25 years old. He's a German churchman. He's already Archbishop of Magdeburg, but he wants to become Archbishop of Mainz. Does anybody know why Mainz is famous? It's where Gutenberg lived. Now, if you're underage, if you're under 25, to become an archbishop is going to cost you $500,000. So what's he going to do? Well, the Pope says, go to the wealthy Fugger family in Augsburg. I was flying to Germany once, and the guy sitting next to me was from Augsburg. And so I asked him, I said, have you ever heard of the Fugger family? He says, oh, yes, I know them well. They live in the mansion up on the hill. My children play with their children. The Fuggers are still in Augsburg. So this is a picture of the bank in Augsburg. So he goes to them, and the Fuggers, who are very wealthy, they are kingmakers. They are emperor, Holy Roman Emperor makers. They are pope makers. They say, tell you what, we'll lend you half the money, but the other half you can raise by selling indulgences. Well, what's an indulgence? Here's their salesman, John Tetzel. He's a Dominican doctor, PhD. Martin Luther, by the way, had a PhD, an earned PhD. Very rare. So this is the Saxony squabble between a Dominican and an Augustinian monk, which is what Luther was, but it's much more than that. So he was coming through Germany, passing through Saxony, where Martin Luther lives, and he was selling indulgences, preaching on behalf of Albert, that boasted that a contribution of money would grant you an indulgence, a piece of paper that would apply even beyond the grave and free souls from purgatory.
Wow.
So, it was popular since the time of the Crusades. The Pope would say to the armies of Christendom, men, go forth and free free Jerusalem from the Muslims, and if you're slain in battle, you go straight to heaven. That's called a plenary indulgence, a full indulgence. You skip purgatory and go straight to heaven. But there are indulgences for smaller things. Robbing a church, perjury, 9 ducats. Murder, only 8 ducats. So murder does pay. He even had a jingle, Tetzel did. When the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. Even in German it rhymes. Well, the idea of selling indulgences, so Martin Luther is walking down the street and comes upon one of his parishioners who he has not seen at confession or at Mass. And he says, "Where have you been? I've not seen you at confession." This is while he's a priest. He's not yet become a Protestant. And the parishioner says, "I don't need to go to confession because I've got this piece of paper that's an indulgence." "Well, how'd you get this piece of paper?" "Well, I was in the next town over, and I paid 8 ducats or whatever, and so I have an indulgence to get out of coming to confession." This year is Jubilee Year in the Roman Catholic Church. It happens every 25 years. It was started by Boniface VIII that we saw. It started in 1300, and it was every 100 years. Then it became every 50 years. Now it's every 25 years. Jubilee Year to the Roman Catholics in Rome, 32 million people come to Rome during Jubilee Year. Why? If you take a pilgrimage from Canterbury, England, which is in the corner of England, come across the English Channel, and you walk through France, Switzerland, the mountains of Italy, and to Rome, to one of 4 basilicas, you'll probably want to go to St. Peter's. If you walk that, bike that, or ride a horse, you will get a plenary indulgence if you walk through the bronze doors of St. Peter's, St. John's, St. Paul's outside the gates, or Santa Maria Maggiore, St. Mary Major. And millions of people do that. There are some people in our class who are with Crew, and they go over and work the path. And they will walk along with pilgrims and ask them spiritual questions. "Why are you doing this pilgrimage?" And they get to share the gospel. So the Mansfields, they're not here this Sunday. But I wrote 3 articles based in part on their experience. One, an article on my blog on pilgrimages. There are a variety of different pilgrimages. Do you know, anybody know the Mulhollands? For the last 20 years, Kate and Kelly have taken people on El Camino de Santiago, the Way of St. James, and that's a pilgrimage that goes to North Spain. There's a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. There's a pilgrimage to Assisi, but the pilgrimage to Rome. And then I talk about the way, the Via Francigena, and then I talk about Jubilee Year. So I published those in the last couple months. Take a look. So selling indulgences. By the way, if you walk 100 kilometers this year to Rome, you get an indulgence. 1 year, no Mass. 1 year, no confession. And you get stamps in your passport. You have to stop there. 80 stops between Canterbury and Rome. But if you do the 100-kilometer one, there are fewer stops. And then you get to St. Peter's, and they sign this, and it's a piece of paper. There was a professor of Bible at the newly founded University of Wittenberg. He was an Augustinian monk. He lived in the Augustinian monastery in Wittenberg. He said, "This is bad theology, if not worse. It is wholly unwarranted by Scripture, by reason, or by tradition. to encourage a person not to repent of their sin, but merely to pay money. So, on October 31st, 1517, he nailed 95 theses, 95 arguments, to the northern wooden door of the Schlosskirche, the castle church in Wittenberg. And it was a call to an academic argument. His 95 theses said that indulgences don't apply to purgatory, that you can't pay for them. It's bad to think that you can pay your way out. And it was a call to an academic debate. He wrote them in Latin so that other scholars would understand what he was writing, but most other people would not, except for the Gutenberg printing press. One of his graduate students took it, translated it into German, and through the help of the movable type printing press, within weeks it had gone beyond Germany. And within months, it was outside the Holy Roman Empire, and it was all over Europe. We'll talk about that next week. Every lesson, I close with one word summary. All you have to do is remember one word, and you've got the whole lesson. In the medieval Catholic Church, you are saved by merit. The merit that you merit by observing the sacraments, which unlock through the auspices of the Roman Catholic Church, the merit from that treasury of merit. Mm. Luther said, well, you'll have to come back next week for that one. All right, do we have any